The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Here on this show, we approach the world, both the religious and the secular world, from the point of view of the Russian Orthodox nationalist tradition. We focus on Russian and Ukrainian history and the Western liturgical tradition, that is the medieval Orthodox tradition, both in the East and the West. And to a great extent, we largely interpret things from the point of view of the medieval world at its best, the high point, at least in my opinion, of the Greco-Roman or Greco-Latin tradition, which forms the intellectual and political foundation of Christendom. And for me, Christendom is identical with the spread of the Orthodox Church, and it does not include later developments of the Roman papacy and Protestantism. And these, in my view, in the view of the Orthodox world, are heretical innovations that actually destroyed and did great damage to the church. What we're going to do is we're going to deal with these topics very explicitly today. And I want to deal with medieval Serbia. As some of you know, I have a book out on the topic, a topic that I wrote several years ago. And I wrote it as a refutation of the very, very bad book that's become very famous, Heavenly Serbia from Myth to Genocide. And I wrote this book as a refutation of that work. So I'm very interested in the Serbian tradition, the Serbian Orthodox tradition. There was a time where I was a part of the Serbian church, my own jurisdiction, which is a true Orthodox church in America, to some extent has a presence in Serbia. And both the medieval and national traditions, in my mind, are one and the same. And the real purpose here, the real purpose of studying the medieval world, is to see the high point, the high development of the Greco-Latin or Greco-Roman tradition, and to study the foundation of the cultures of the great European states, but that culture is ultimately religious, as the word culture itself seems to imply. The culture of the West is religious, and it takes the insights of Plato and brings them down to earth in the person of Christ. And that Greco-Latin tradition found its intellectual apogee in Christ as a unity of both the heavenly and the earthly, divinity and the human. And so the intellectual comprehension of that came from the church fathers, both writing in Greek and in Latin. And these are the men who put the Bible together. So the Bible is secondary in the sense that it was put together and analyzed and interpreted by the fathers of the church, who have equal authority to the scriptures in that they're the ones who pass judgment on it, and what books are in and what books are out. Anyway, we have dealt with Byzantium on this show, and you really can't deal with medieval Serbia unless you deal with its relationship to Byzantium and its own neighborhood, Bulgaria and Hungary. Now, when we talked about Byzantium on this show, we left off really talking about Basil II. Basil II, one of the greatest monarchs in all history, one of the greatest Roman emperors, and he, like Alex Comnenus in 1081, saved the empire. And the empire considered itself Israel. It considered itself the New Jerusalem, and that it was the political foundation of the church. So it held explicitly that it, the Roman Empire in the East, Byzantium, is New Rome. It is also New Jerusalem, and therefore it is a synthesis of Athens and Jerusalem, so to speak. And so they viewed themselves as the chosen people, and that the promises made to the Israelites in the Old Testament applied to it, the Roman Empire in the East, and that the Hebrews and later the Jews, they killed their own prophets, they destroyed their own tradition, they became pagans as they are today, and therefore the promises made to them were revoked through their sins and through their rejection of Christ, and then placed on Christ, needless to say, and the church that he formed, the Orthodox Church, and its political foundation, which was the Roman Empire. So that's the foundation. That's the foundation of everything that we do on this show, and is the political foundation of the European world, of Christendom, and everything that the Greco-Roman tradition is all about. And, you know, Basil II had brought the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman Empire, to its highest point of expansion. And unfortunately, his successors, there were two women, Zoe and Theodora, who were absolutely disastrous. And it took Alex Comnenus to save the empire and to put it on a stronger military footing. And it was in that context of the failure of the reforms of Basil II after his death where the Serbs had declared independence. Now, as this is going on, the Normans, the descendants of the Vikings that had been settled in northern France, took South Italy. They took Sicily. The Turkish Empire was growing, and at the same time, Venice is rising as a major commercial power. The Arabs, as a military force, were smashed in 1055 by the Turks. So Byzantium here is finding itself, let's say, the second half of the 11th century, completely surrounded. It had Hungary, Bulgaria, and Serbia to the north. It had the Ottoman Empire, which was growing immensely in power, to the south. And to the west and southwest, the very well-organized Norman forces that were dealing quite regularly with the Venetians. So this is a time of crisis after the death of Basil II. And military action was taken in 1067 and afterwards by Romanus IV. And, of course, a famous defeat at Manzikert in Asia Minor really dealt a tremendous blow to the Greeks, to the Roman Empire. And then the Turks were able to take over all of Asia Minor. And Turkish immigrants were sent all over to the places that they had conquered from the Greeks and were in the process of creating a substantial empire. So it took the new line, the Komnenoi, led by Alexis, who finally took over and saved the empire from these disasters in 1081. And he started a new dynasty. Heraclius, Leo, Basil I, these men had done the same thing. But the female rule of Zoe and Theodora turned out to be a disaster. And one of the things that the Komnenoi had done under Alexios's rule is to defeat the Norman power on the sea. The rise of Venice, and ultimately the Komnenoi made a deal with Venice to keep them at arm's length, one of the reforms that they engaged in was that the land power has to be supplemented with sea power. And the Venetians convinced them that this was true. The Byzantine navy had largely been substantial over the centuries, but had fallen into neglect under previous rulers. The deal that he made with Venice was that if they were to supply the fleet, you know, weapons, sailors, and everything else to the Roman Empire in the east, the Venetians, their merchants, which is all Venice was a merchant republic, were given tax freedom tax haven, essentially, in Greek lands. And ultimately what happened was that Constantinople became slowly but surely an economic colony of Venice. And one of the main, at least in my opinion, one of the main causes of the fall of Constantinople after 1,000 years of existence was that the currency and many of the economic elites fell into the hands of Venice, and the money then left the control of the emperor. Now, economically speaking, what occurs is that Genoa had assisted a new dynasty in coming to power, because they saw Constantinople as an economic colony of Venice, and because Constantinople was so wealthy and so ideally situated, the Genoese eventually will finance the Periologos dynasty into taking authority in Constantinople, and this is the final dynasty of the Byzantine Empire. The concept of Byzantium, Constantinople as New Rome, which is in the canons of the Orthodox Church refer to Constantinople as the New Rome. The Roman concept here was destroyed at the Fourth Crusade when the Western Crusaders sacked and destroyed Constantinople. The empire then shrunk, and even when the Greek Empire was able to resuscitate itself, it became a national Greek state rather than the true successors of the Roman Empire. And ultimately, it's the Greek nobility in alliance with the Venetians that destroys the basic moral fabric of the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. So that's the historical and economic context of the rise of the medieval Serbian Empire. The problems at the end of the reign of Basil II, the problems that affected the Byzantine Empire, say, from between 1060 to 1100, and that these will dictate much of Byzantine history until its final destruction from the Turks in 1453. The empire did not have a national base. It was multi-ethnic. Greek was the official language, Orthodoxy the official religion, but it was a multinational empire. Its oligarchy, its absentee landlords were everywhere, and they were very powerful. The succession crises were constant, and this is a feature of the Roman political system. The native Greek merchant class was declining, and the Jewish and Venetian merchant classes were rising. And the Jewish merchant classes in Byzantium were Assyrian Jews who were operating in Greek lands, and then, of course, later became supporters of the Ottoman Empire because it unified their markets. Italian competition, the fusion of the court and the army, noble violence, all of these were severe problems that the Byzantine Empire, which probably was the best organized bureaucratic colossus in the history of the world, the true final succession of the Roman Empire in southern Europe, and then Russia, the Russian royal family will eventually marry into the Byzantine line, and so it's able to continue in Kiev and then later Vladimir, and then from Vladimir to Moscow. But the concept is that the empire was meant to be centrally run by the emperor and patriarch working together. It was a centralized bureaucratic apparatus, and with a very strong army and navy and intelligence service, which the Byzantines had really perfected. And this very, very strong Greek Orthodox Christian basis created the moral foundations of this 1,000-year military empire. But as cracks were seen, as chinks could be found in the armor, the Balkans began to develop its very specific kind of politics. And the Serbs then developed an empire which eventually reached its height in the 14th century, what we would call the High Middle Ages in the West. Now, I'm dealing with Byzantium for the sake of dealing with Serbia. Today is November 12th, 2011, and on the old calendar it is a feast day of one of my favorite monarchs, a saint in the Orthodox Church, one of the patrons of Serbia, and that is Stepanja Juroš the second. And since all Serbian kings are named Stephen, it's tough to keep them apart, so we use their given names. And the person who we're dealing with is Milutin. And Milutin, Saint Milutin, monarch of Serbia, is one of the most focused and moral political leaders of the Middle Ages. And he set the standard, religious, economic, and political, for this tremendously wealthy and just Serbian empire of the 13th and 14th century, founded by another saint, Saint Stepan Nemanja. And it comes into existence largely because the Greek Empire, the Byzantine Empire, was slowly but surely declining. And it could not hold, at least successfully, its Balkan possessions. Now, the tribal leader called the Župan, normally these local nobles, the Župan was more or less a tribal military leader. These men in Serbia normally paid tribute to Byzantium. And the tribal organization, this collection of households, the Zadruga, which we have dealt with on this show before, the foundation of the Serbian political and economic order, this collection of households into this very large extended family, was led by a Župan. And the Županje normally gave their allegiance to the Byzantine Empire, and eventually were brought into the Orthodox Church. The rise of Bulgaria, as initially a pagan empire and then converting to the Orthodox Church, their aggression in the Balkans is one of the things that forced Serbia to turn to Byzantium and to make an ally out of it. And even in the middle of the 11th century, when Basil II was still alive, the Serbs were allied with Basil, but then when he died, Zoe and Theodora take over. There's a period of crisis and decline. This is when the Serbian, very explicit Serbian ethnic nationalist movement came into existence. The unification of all Serbs within the Orthodox Church, with a great level and a great degree of influence from Byzantium. The Serbs are a mountain people, and mountaineers, as you find, for example, in Montenegro, are very, very difficult to defeat and battle. The Zita coastal Županje, Zita, of course, is the old name for Montenegro, and these are the men who became very powerful and who really became the nucleus of the Serbian military forces. And this struggle against the Greeks on the one hand and the Bulgarians on the other, this created a very specific Serbian religious and ethnic consciousness, which will then explode under people like Stepan and his successors, and reach its high point and in the very famous rule of Tsar Dušan, really the last significant Serbian emperor of the Middle Ages. And this struggle defines the Serbian mentality. And Central Serbia rose to prominence under the leadership of Saint Stepan Nemanja. He created a sort of a mini imitation of the Byzantine state. He wanted a bureaucratized, centralized institution. And, it was influenced and creatively influenced by Slav, Greek, and Latin culture and tradition, and you see quite a bit of it kind of synthesized in this westernized Slavic and yet still Orthodox group of people, the Serbs and Montenegrins. And the mountain forces, both of Raška and Zita, which eventually, both of them together will form the core of Serbia, won many victories against the Greeks and the Bulgarians because of their tremendous ability to fight in the mountains, and their tremendous family, this extended family system of support, gave them a tremendous both moral and material basis on which to fight. So the point is, as Byzantium declines, and it declined for all the reasons that I gave, the formerly subject people of the empire began to declare independence. When I say subject people, I'm being very dramatic, because typical Byzantine and Roman approach was never to dominate its opponents. And it's the Roman idea that can synthesize a real empire on the one hand and nationalism on the other. So long as the local leaders paid their tribute to the center, they were able to rule themselves as an ethnic and religious unit. They were given an independent church. They had an independent economic life. But the fact is that the empire provided them with a very large market in which their native merchant classes can then develop. So for all of its flaws and problems, the Roman system, whether in Italy or in Greece, split the difference between ethnic nationalism on the one hand, which was very, very real at the time, and the significance of political and religious unity on the other. So think of the empire more as a federation of independent states, all paying tribute to the center and receiving as much in terms of benefits as it does in payment, both military in kind as well as in money. Empires are a perennial problem. They are almost inherently unstable. I think that a strong nation is always capable of defeating a divided empire. But that's a separate question. The fact is, both the Byzantine Empire, which is centered in the Greek language, and the Serbian Empire, which is centered on the southern and western Slavic language, which will eventually become a Serbian, closely related to Croatian, of course, it's using two different alphabets. These are both empires and national states. And they're capable of synthesizing the best in the ethnic idea and the best in the idea of universal political rule in the form of a federation. But at the period of time we're talking about the development of the Komnenoi, of the dynasty founded by Alexios Komnenos. This is the dynasty, and this is a period of time where Serbia will declare its independence and slowly develop a Balkan empire that is the equal to the Byzantine Empire in every way. And under Stepan Dušan, he even made the claim to Constantinople. He made the claim to be the head of a Slavo-Greek empire, and groups like the Romanians and others had supported his drive to become emperor. And had he become emperor, he, at least in my opinion, would have saved Constantinople. So we're going to talk more specifically about Serbia and the Serbian Empire in the Middle Ages when we return.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, we are back. We are talking about Serbia and the Balkans in the Middle Ages, both relative to the slow and agonizing decline of the Byzantine Empire and the rise and very rapid decline of the Serbian Empire in the 14th century. We started with, you know, the end of the reign of Basil II, centuries before that, because that's kind of the intellectual and economic foundation for the rise of the institutions like the Ottoman Empire, the taking of South Italy by the Normans, the economic colonization of Greek lands by the Venetians and the Jews. These are all central issues. But as Byzantium declines, in the 13th and 14th century, the high point of the Middle Ages, Serbia comes into its own as an empire synthesizing Greek, Slavic, and to some minor extent, Latin influences into a very unique South Slavic culture. Stepan Nemanja is the founder of this dynasty. His successor is Stepan II. He's known as Stephen Dukonski, or Stephen the First Crowned. He had actually gone to the Pope of Rome and received his first crown from the papacy in order to provide him with leverage against the Greeks. But after 1204, where the Crusaders had destroyed Byzantium, he didn't have much of a choice except to go to Rome and ally with the Roman papacy. On the coastal areas, the city of Ragusa, otherwise known as Dubrovnik, the Latin and papal Italian influences were very substantial. Saint Sava, the patron of Serbia, who was closely related to the Nemanja line, would have been a prince in and of himself, but had went to Mount Athos to become a monk instead. Sava went to the Greeks, specifically the rump empire of Nicaea. After the destruction of Constantinople, the Greek military had formed small sort of mini-states, Epirus and Nicaea. Nicaea was a larger Greek state and did eventually seek to retake Constantinople from the Crusaders, largely of Norman background. Saint Sava was strictly Orthodox and had refused this concept of Stepan II, the first crown, going to Rome for his legitimacy. And so Saint Sava went to the Greek state of Nicaea and received a patent from the patriarch there at the time, the head of the church there, sort of the patriarch of Constantinople in exile, to create a completely independent Serbian church, eventually with its own patriarch. And this was a way that Saint Sava was capable of checking this going to the Roman papacy for assistance. And Stepan II very soon repudiated his allegiance to the Pope of Rome and accepted the mediation of his brother Saint Sava and received his own patent for an independent church and the moral grounding for an independent state, an empire, from the Greek state of Nicaea, which is what was left of the Byzantine Empire after it was sacked in 1204 by this coalition of the Crusaders and the Venetians. Now, as this is going on, the Bulgarians are developing their own institutions. Under John Ashen and Peter, rebelled against their titular Byzantine overlords because of high taxes. The Tsar Karolian, essentially the leader of the Bulgars in Balkans, had assisted in the destruction of Constantinople and actually permitted and the invasion of the Crusaders, and the bulk of the Greek army had been destroyed. As it turns out, the Bulgarians also did tremendous damage to the crusading armies as well, viewing both Greeks and Crusaders as a threat. Karolian actually also went to the Roman papacy to be crowned, and he was succeeded by John Ashen II. And so the problem here is that you're developing a strong and what appears to be a Roman Catholic Bulgarian state, which will have a very short life because it will be eventually destroyed by the Mongols. But what's happening in Bulgaria is that Bulgarian pagan leaders, Bulgarian Christian leaders are fighting one another. Paganism was marked by its hostility to the Greeks. The Orthodox Christian leadership was marked by their support of the Greeks and their support of the Greek Empire. like every other place, the former colonies of Constantinople now are free to a great extent because Constantinople has been sacked and destroyed. And so both Serbs and Bulgarians take advantage. The political leadership in its divided state even was particularly talented and were able to destroy what was left of the Greeks and the Balkans on the one hand, and also do tremendous damage to the Crusaders on the other. The constant pressure from the Balkans is one of the reasons that the initial Crusades did very poorly. The Crusade that destroyed Constantinople in 1204 was specifically the Fourth Crusade, and really nothing ever succeeded after the first. The first was the biggest and the best, and after that, the Crusades really petered out, and the Fourth Crusade was as much directed against the Greeks as it was against the Muslims. So the successor to Nemanja is Stephen II, or Stephen Dukhansky. Now, just so we know, we've bounced around a little bit here, but just to give a sense of the dates, Stepan Nemanja will die on Mount Athos in 1196. King Stefan II, or the first crowned, will die in 1228. Stepan Uros will die in 1276, and the person that we're interested in today, Stepan Uros II, Milutin, will die in 1321. So that's the period of time that we're dealing with here, and that period of time sees the decline of Byzantium, the destruction of Byzantium by the Crusaders, and then the rise of the Normans in South Italy, the rise of Venice, the rise and thriving of Venice economically, and also the rise of, or the continued development of Hungary. So the context is very complicated, and you have the remnants of paganism in parts of Bulgaria. You have the Roman Catholics in Hungary and in the coastal areas of the Adriatic, Dalmatia and parts of Montenegro. Islam, needless to say, Judaism, which was dominant wherever you had any merchant colony. And then, of course, the Orthodox Church, which was the most significant. The Roman Catholics were really a part of the Venetian movement, the Venetian development. Venice was an independent church, but it had largely bought its independence from the Roman papacy. The different combatants here, the real complexity of this era is that developing understanding the interests of all of these different combatants, and eventually the Mongols, who will destroy the Bulgarians. The understanding here is based around their interests, who they served, and what that service meant for them. And that's how you kind of understand the kaleidoscope of movements here. Once you understand what was motivating each one, it all begins to make sense. Bulgaria and Serbia were largely rivals for power in the Balkans. Constantinople was totally knocked out of power in 1204, but places like Nicaea still maintained the military and economic base of the empire. Of course, Venice cared only about money. The Jews in the coastal areas cared only about money. And the Roman Church was interested in doing whatever it could to do harm and damage to the Orthodox Church, especially that of the Greeks in the Balkans. And so the papacy, while it didn't like the slaughter and the genocide of the Crusaders in Constantinople, and to be fair, Pope Innocent did condemn that. However, they did take advantage of it and installed their own Latin-speaking bishops in Constantinople, who, needless to say, were extremely unpopular with the local population. The Venetians were a hated group of people, because they were interlopers, they were Roman Catholics, they seemed to have no moral code, and they existed to profit from the Greeks. And they viewed Greeks as simply their hired labor, and yet the fact is that the Byzantine Empire permitted the Venetians to have tax-free status, everyone else had to pay taxes, in exchange for the fleet. Venice developed the way it did, at least as far as Greece is concerned, because the emperors had permitted it to do so in exchange for the building up of its naval power. But the Venetians were very quickly able to turn on their hosts and support and provide the ships to the crusaders, who will eventually destroy Constantinople. And so, needless to say, the Venetians and the Jews simply came in and colonized the area. Byzantium developed into this powerful, globally powerful, globally significant state based on two economic things. First of all, the currency was very tightly controlled in the person of the emperor. And number two, the development of the empire's economic potential revolved around a standard 12% tariff that was placed on all imports, regardless on where it came from. So needless to say, this is something that forced the Venetians to take political action in eventually overthrowing this government in Greece, so that it could then control the currency, break down tariff barriers, and to hopefully colonize the area. And so their rivals in Italy, the Genoese, eventually will make alliances with pretty much anybody else that they could to continue to keep up with this Venetian development. Their colonization of Byzantium was completely amoral, and it destroyed the society. But from an economic point of view, it was absolutely brilliant and showed their tremendous ability. The Italians laid the groundwork for modern banking. I mean, the Jews will eventually take it over, but the initial intellectual and institutional groundwork was 100% Italian. And so the Italians and the Jews became enemies, and ultimately the Jews were throwing their lot with the Muslims, as they normally did, and so they were able to dominate in the Turkish Empire to a great extent. But like wherever they go, they normally accumulate so much money and do it with no desire or no care for anybody around them, and they eventually get they get kicked out. And there were riots against the Jews in Turkey, in Byzantium, and in Venice itself. So economically speaking, the real power after 1204 is a battle between Genoa and Venice for what was left of the Greek Empire. Now, it isn't spoken of very much, but the Serbian armies did defeat the Mongols after their destruction of Bulgaria. They clearly proved their mettle here. The Mongols were very much overextended. I mean, this is the very fringes of the penetration of that empire. But the destruction of Bulgaria by the Mongols permitted Serbia to build this empire. The Venetians will eventually assist Serbia in resisting their Western European Angevin rivals as they develop their power in Hungary. So Serbian development here was this tremendous balancing act, and it really wasn't only until Tsar Dušan, who will eventually come to defeat Hungary, and he's given quite a bit of money from the Venetians in order to make that happen. But then he took Ragusa, or the trading city on the Adriatic, known, Ragusa is Italian name, Dubrovnik is a Slavic name. And this eventually drove the Venetians away from their alliance with the Serbs, and they will hire a Greek to poison Stepan Dušan, and he dies in his 40s. He had a whole long career ahead of him, and he could have saved the Byzantine Empire and unified the entire Balkans, South Italy, and Asia Minor, but he was poisoned before he could do that. Now, prior to Dušan, the work of Stephen II, or Stephen the First Crown, also a saint, he had defeated the Bulgarians but didn't take it. He permitted the Bulgarians to organize their own life, but still, at least formally, subject to the Serbian Empire. One of the things that permits Serbia to develop is that the Venetians, because for a time they are supporting Serbia they're supporting Serbia to destroy their rivals in Hungary. And so the Venetians and the Hungarians will directly go to war roughly around the same time that Byzantium is dying. And this is what permits Serbia to develop. And they develop largely on the basis of, among other things, but their main, one of their main products is silver. The word Serbia is a lot like the word Argentina. They're both similar in that they're different languages describing silver. Srebrenica is known simply as the town of silver, the land of silver. It is a silver mining town. This was a way that Serbian Empire was able to support itself, to coin its own money, and it was able to challenge all comers because of the tremendous amount of silver that was available in Serbia. And the Serbs did a very smart thing by bringing in the Saxons from Germany. They permitted them to organize their own guild, gave them national independence on Serbian soil, charged them very, very low taxes because the Saxons were the best miners in the world. And in permitting these Saxon colonies and guilds under Serbian control, but favored by them, Serbia became a major power. And this is why Milutin is one of the most significant figures of the Eastern Middle Ages. He rules from 1282 to 1321. He is the most significant Serbian ruler because Tsar Dušan, who will lead Serbia to its largest and highest level of expansion, the economic basis of Serbia was laid by Milutin. The region of Macedonia was very, very well developed. Serbia had developed both its silver and its viniculture, or its wine was prized all over Europe. The amount of money that they were able to make through its silver mining helped finance really some of the most advanced agricultural techniques in the world. There was a 10% tax on all smelted silver, which meant a tremendous amount of money for the monarchy. And vines, the development of bean crops, grains and cattle, and of course the famous plums of Serbia really created an advanced and wealthy agricultural economy, which was very fair in terms of the distribution of wealth. And that is one of the central themes of the book that I wrote, Heavenly Serbia and the Medieval Idea. In that it really was a firmly nationalist state based on the solidarity of all classes. And I think that there's a lot of evidence that that's the case. The broader point is that the money economy, even prior to Milutin, he's Uroš II, Uroš I, had laid the groundwork for a money economy. So Serbia, at the time of Uroš II, Milutin, is one of the most advanced economies in the world. It had taken over the Byzantine approach to things. It had used Byzantine coins, but Milutin is the first to centralize a mint coining system in his own office. And he mints his own coins, the dinar. And then eventually when the Greek Empire reorganizes itself, they will use the dinar because it's an equal to their own currency. And so the mining success had tremendous ripple effects. Serbia becomes the wealthiest society in the High Middle Ages. It has the most powerful money economy. A market economy is developing in the towns and the monasteries. It's a highly literate society. The access to the Adriatic created a thriving trading system that eventually is going to compete directly with the Venetians, and under Tsar Dušan will eventually lead to conflict with the Venetians. But under Milutin, Bulgaria is not a major player. Hungary is at war with Venice. Byzantium is still a mess. And the defeat of the Normans on sea by the Byzantine Navy is a tremendous success. Fact is that in Milutin's era, really the high Middle Ages in the Serbian world as well as is in the Western world, you have the wealthiest, most advanced economy in Europe, and the economic basis, both in agriculture and in mining, had these ripple effects, and these effects were the development of technology, the development of methods of powering equipment, and of course in the mountains in that part of the world you have a lot of these waterfalls and harnessing water for power, on and on and on. I mean, they take the best from the Greek and from the Latin world and create this immensely powerful, well-run empire. The perpetual problem always is the increasingly wealthy nobles who don't want to pay taxes to the king anymore and who will make an alliance. Eventually, this is what's going to happen. The Venetians and the papacy will make an alliance with some of these disgruntled nobles and seek to overthrow the Tsar that way. But ultimately, the only way to deal with the tremendous success of Tsar Dushan, who took this money and took this tremendous ability and productivity and created and added military genius on top of it, this was the creation of an immense empire, and only his murder leads to its downfall, because it's not too long after that the Turks will eventually penetrate Europe and make war on the Serbian Empire. The death of Dušan is one of the most central events in European history in the Middle Ages, because had he taken over Constantinople, he would have been able to save the empire. So the nature of Serbdom, the Serbian political vision as it developed in the Middle Ages, I think could be summarized this way. Each house, each extended family develops its own enclosed community and economy. This is why the rewards of labor in Serbia were extremely evenly distributed, because you were never dealing with individuals. You were dealing with very large communities based on some kind of blood tie. These households, or the zadruge, were autarkic. They were largely self-supporting, and these were the means whereby the fruits of people's labor were distributed. In the cities, the brotherhoods developed, the so-called Russian artel, mutual aid societies were everywhere, and kind of took the idea of the druga and brought it to the industrial world, and brought it to the urban world. All of these villages, these collections of households, elected their own elders and were always fiercely independent in how they ran things. The school system was very well developed in the Serbian Middle Ages, based exclusively on the monasteries using both Greek and Slavic as their main mode of writing communication, and were tightly connected with Mount Athos. So really the best of the Greek civilization in that part of the world. These extended families, the Raduga, were also churches. The head of the family was also, in a sense, a priest. Because as the empire develops, there simply weren't enough priests, and so the father of the family took on many non-sacramental but yet very important religious positions. And Serbia, as many of you know, is unique in the sense that individuals do not have patron saints. The extended family has a patron saint, and that is called the Slava, or the Glorification Day. And so it's the extended family that is both the economic and the religious center of medieval Serbia. And even these villages also elected the monastic abbot, who, of course, you know, oversaw a substantial monastic complex based on writing, translation, agriculture, and the peasants living on monastic lands were taxed very, very little and were always exempt from military service. And the education was tremendous, especially in Greek, but the gusla songs, this kind of the wandering minstrel, which you see in Ukraine as well, these were central in maintaining historical memory, even after Dušan, when eventually Serbia will fall to the Turks and become for several hundred years a colony, a direct and oppressed colony of the Turkish Empire. And all of this development will be destroyed by the Turks, who then will colonize the Balkans for a long period of time. Well, anyway, I know we've covered a lot of ground here. I've been all over the place in terms of dates, but I want to set up a conceptual apparatus for you to consider to understand this era. And I know it's difficult, but you could always email me for any questions, and I could further develop this idea in future shows. And in medieval Serbia is a huge area for me, and I'm going to continue to develop it. And I will ask you to buy my book on this topic, because there I have a lot of original research that has not been done before on medieval institutions and the ideology, both religious and political, of the Serbian monarchy. So I hope to hear from you, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.